Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cubbins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And it's good to be back, because we have been gone for a while. We have been cruising along the beautiful shores of France, Spain, and places like Rennes-le-Château and various other places. And here we are back behind a microphone speaking to you, because the world hasn't stopped as we have been touring the world. It's a strange concept, but there it is. But we have been very busy, and the world has been very busy, and that I think is something which is really rising to the forefront. And as I got back into a normal groove, so to speak, there really were several things which came to my attention. And one of the things is obviously that last weekend there were elections in various places. There were elections in Egypt, there were elections in Greece, in Great Britain, where I currently am. There are wild, not necessarily even rumors, not even speculation, I would actually say conversations about Greece leaving the euro and how really the future of Europe is going to be completely different from what it was imagined to be 10 years ago. And I, as usual, when I am back in civilization, there were some radio interviews. And during one of those radio interviews, really what came to my mind was this idea that we keep saying, and I specifically keep saying, that 2012 is about this global village, that we are, you know, able to fly around the world in 2 days at the cost of roughly an average monthly salary, that we are able to communicate with anybody in the world, sometimes at completely no cost whatsoever, that we have people picking up the phones in India, sometimes whether we like it or not, and that all our furniture seems to be coming from China, and that this is really an indication of how truly global our village has become. But at the same time, Europe is, you know, kind of fighting with this. And the little joke I have been making to myself is that the only thing of European global village seems to be the Euro 2012 soccer, which is going on, as well as the annual Eurovision Song Contest, which for people who are not exposed to this, bless you. But for those of you who are, it is basically a song contest of crap songs, and played out at a European stage, in the sense that it's like a competition. And the only other thing really of what European government has ever tried to do in really making its citizens behave as if they are anything to do whatsoever across the border is the twinning of towns, so that a town can be twinned with another town in Europe. But really there is very little of real village-like atmosphere with Europe, and I think that is becoming more and more apparent. It is becoming apparent that one we consider to be a European Union really is not unified at all, that these are nations which have been forced to work together, quite often, you know, by politicians or against their distress. And it is sad to really see, and the reaction of the people across Europe clearly is that they have no idea what to do. And in Greece the elections are that really there is no change, and that is probably an indication enough that really the people are divided. But that really, I think we have been seeing this on our travels, really, that the financial crisis is hitting hard in Europe. France pretty much is quite okay, because it is a very large economy. But definitely in Spain we saw far fewer tourists, and we also, of course, heard the stories about how the tourist industry in Spain has to make decisions whether to keep open, and how the tourist industry in Greece has actually decided to close, therefore by default not giving any possibility of recovering from the situation which they're in. It's really an interesting moment in time. And obviously, you have gone back to America, Kathleen, and you have been once again prominently exposed to the race there for the presidency. And again, there, I think it's pretty much business as usual. I don't think there's anything new. There's nothing specifically high powered about it.
It's a very strange time to be an American, I have to tell you. It's a very strange time to be a woman in America as well. Yes, the elections are you know, gearing up for November, but it's not certainly not like it was 4 years ago. And part of that is because the Republican Party is a mess, and you know, it took them a really long time to decide that they wanted Mitt Romney to run against Barack Obama, but of course it's far too late for them really to have put anything together that's going to matter. There's not a chance in hell that Romney's going to win. But what's happening in America for me is actually quite disturbing, and that's that there's this strange backlash into extremism. And I was actually talking with my oldest son about this today. We have a lot of these conversations. He's a very philosophical kid, and you know, we talk about the state of the world, and he's old enough to vote now, and you know, he has a sense of 2012 and shift and things happening, and I, you know, one of the things that we were discussing is there seems to be this sort of, there's like this last ditch desire right now for a lot of very scared patriarchal people who have been in power, who are becoming like, it's crazy. They're becoming actually crazy in their bid to hang on to their power. And in doing so, the extremism is insane. I mean, you know, here in America, and we have listeners from all over the world, so I always find that some of them will write to me after I talk about something that happens in the States, and they'll say, really? Does that really happen in America? When we had a woman, an elected official, a member of the legislature in Michigan, was suspended for saying the word vagina in a debate on the floor this week. Now, she said it, by the way, while discussing abortion rights and women's reproductive rights. So let's face it, we're talking about vaginas. There should be nothing wrong with her saying that. But of course, the male patriarchal conservative extremists pulled her out, and she no longer has a voice. She's been suspended. She's been punished for saying this word, and it's astonishing to me, and it's astonishing to me that more people aren't screaming about it. It's like, wait a minute, you know, let's talk about what this really is here. This is about a woman taking her power and speaking her mind in an important debate and them silencing her. If a man had said it, no one would have cared. Actually, if a conservative had said it, no one would have cared, because it was a liberal woman who is trying to make a point about how unacceptable it is to legislate against women's bodies. And that's why she was penalized. And there is this war against women that is being escalated here in America. And I find it absolutely terrifying.
Well, and why do you think it is happening? Is it simply because is it because of the women's vote? Is it because of the fact that somehow these people are trying to stop the inevitable from happening, or what is happening?
Basically, I think it is a backlash against this idea of progress. I think that whether it's conscious or unconscious, that there is this realization that's happening at, you know, these last throes of the patriarchy, these last throes of the people who used to be in control of everything that was. I think there's this element of we're losing that, and how do we get it back? And it's, you know, we're going to crack down. We're going to become even more conservative. And one of the things that we have to do is put women in their place. Nancy Pelosi scared the hell out of people. Hillary Clinton scares the hell out of people. This idea of powerful women in politics is something that the conservatives really, really have an issue with. And, you know, and the conservative women are as extreme as the conservative men. I mean, there's a lot of crazy on the female side of conservative politics in America. You know, you've got people like Michelle Bachmann, who makes Sarah Palin look sane, and Sarah Palin's out of her mind. as a woman right now in America, I feel like Alice when I, you know, having gone through the Looking Glass. It's like everything's kind of upside down, and people are screaming off with their heads, and Alice is you know being thrown into the punishment corner for saying a word that she's not allowed to say. It's very, very strange time, and I, you know, what happened this week with this woman being suspended for saying the word vagina in a debate about women's productive rights because she, quote, said a bad word. It's like something that Matilda would have encountered, you know, going against the church in you know, 1089. This is not something that should be happening in America in the 21st century. But I also think that there is a diversion here. I think the idea is with the conservatives, if we can get people upset enough about all these little things, they're not paying attention to some of the bigger issues, some of these things that that still need to be dealt with that are a true mess in America. And I guess, you know, like someone on my Facebook yesterday was saying, well, what do we do about it? What do we as women do about it? And that's the big question. It's concerning because we don't have any great leaders. What we need is someone who can step forward and say, we need to do something about this. As every woman in this country who has the ability to vote and the ability to be outraged by what is happening right now were to do something about it, we would change the world. But it's just so hard to mobilize people, particularly in an economy where everyone is depressed. People are trying right now in America just to get through the day. They're trying to figure out how they're going to feed their kids. They're trying out how are they going to continue to put gas in their car when the prices of fuel are going up. They are completely beaten down. I have never seen my country like this. And it's extremely frustrating. And I don't know what the answer is, but I know that the center cannot hold. I know that it can't continue like this, that something has got to change.
Well, and I think that that's actually a quite similar situation to you know, large sections of Europe, where you really see that people are trying to keep this thing of the euro alive, but everybody pretty much knows it's dead. It's almost like, you know, everybody knows it's terminal, but nobody really knows its date of when it is going to collapse. And you can kind of like count probably as to how much more money Germany will have to feed into this monster for it to keep itself alive. But once Germany pulls the plug, literally there is no brainwave anymore. And to a large extent, it is a very bizarre situation that this program of the euro was created, and there was never any idea about an exit strategy. It was just felt that this was, you know, almost like divine, and it would never fail. And as a result of that, there is no exit strategy. A country like Greece, who would, I think, dearly would like to leave it, simply has no means of doing so because it was never envisaged. And as a result of that, you know, the people of Greece are in dire straits. It's a silly example, but of all the swimming pools in Greece, Olympic-sized swimming pools, apparently only one can be heated. All the other ones are simply closed because there is simply no money anymore to heat a swimming pool. And that is kind of like, you know, the extent to which Greece is being affected. That very basic things simply are completely unable of being done, and you know that there is massive poverty there, and no real means of an escape either. And when you look at it, you know, you really wonder why. What is the situation here? Why people in Greece are starving? Why people, are dire? Where, you know, not necessarily just in Greece, but across Europe, and as you see in America, people are committing suicide because they cannot sustain their families anymore. They have no more means out. And in the case of Greece, it's completely artificially created. Somebody decided that we should all adopt a different currency, and then, oops, somebody forgot to actually create an exit strategy. And as a result, people are in dire straits in a country like Greece. And it is, again, a completely fabricated crisis, but somehow, it is a reality. And that I find is just so weird and also so wrong. And what I find the saddest part is that the average person is completely disabled. He is completely incapable of doing something. And I look towards pretty much Egypt and still see the protest there, and I see the Western media reporting and saying, oh look, the entire Egyptian dream has collapsed, and the answer to some extent is, well, yes and no. But what is happening in Egypt is, as soon as something bad happens in Egypt, people go to that square and say, yeah, maybe not, and they force their leaders to change their position. And that is something which the Egyptians have been doing for 15, 16 months now, and which people in the Western world don't seem to get through their heads, that they can change their governments. It's the old classic adage of vivo vendetta, the government should be afraid of the people. Yet what I find is that in the Western world, people are afraid of their government. And as you said, like, where is the moral outrage for this woman being silenced by somebody who just decides that it is inappropriate to use that word? And where everybody, I think, will completely agree, in a completely ridiculous circumstance.
It's a very difficult conversation to have right now, because there are so many layers to it. There's so many levels. I mean, even when talking about Greece, again, it's very interesting and also very frustrating for me as someone who lives bicontinentally right now as often as I do. I mean, right now I don't even know what time zone I'm in because I've been spending so much time on planes. But to be in Europe 2 weeks ago for the last, 6 weeks before that, listening to nothing but what's happening with Greece and what's happening in the Eurozone and how it dramatically impacts every aspect of the world economy. But then you come here, people just don't get it. I mean, it might be a little bit of a news story, kind of at the end, but people here don't understand it. They don't understand how it is that this little tiny island country in the Mediterranean can impact the American economy. They don't understand. So my conspiracy theory is, and I don't mean this from a conspiratorial kind of way, because I'm not a fan of the whole New World Order and, that kind of thing. I don't believe that it's happening at that scale. But what I do think is maybe, just maybe, there is some element of what's happening in Greece having this ripple effect that impacts the whole world is maybe about waking people up just a little bit more to this idea that we are a global community, that what happens in Greece is going to affect us, and that we need to start caring. Maybe that we as Americans have to expand our scope a little bit and understand how we are this part of a much larger organism, which is the world. And I don't know, and maybe that's naive, I don't know, but there is this element of everything in the world is really screwed up right now. Everyone is in chaos. Everything is tumultuous, and maybe that is what 2012 is about. Maybe 2012 is about shaking everything up, because it can't stay the way it is. It can't lie dormant anymore. We're killing the planet. We're killing each other. Something has to change. I'm in an interesting place with this right now, because I'm actually very frustrated. Because like yesterday, when women on my Facebook page were saying to me, who's going to lead this revolution of women? Who's going to do something about it? There was a part of me that said, I should step up here and say, I am, and pick up this flag and run with this and become a real activist for this and do something about it. And I thought, I'm just too tired and I'm too busy. I have too many other things to do. And then I spent the rest of the day feeling bad about that, because I'm thinking, crap, am I one of those people? Am I one of those people who says I'm going to wait for everyone else to change the world? I don't ever want to be that. I don't ever want to be that. I want to be the person who gets out there and says, this is wrong and I'm going to do something about it. And I do that in my work. But I think that we're all being called to do a little bit more. And that's what I'm struggling with. And I hear that with a lot of women right now here, a lot of women who are really conscious and they do want to change the world. And there are a lot of things that they want to get done, and they have the courage, you know, they have the drive, they have the spirit for it. They are spirit revolutionaries, but they're tired. They're tired because they're trying to get through their everyday lives and take care of their kids and their family and everything else. And saving the world sometimes has to wait. But then there's that piece of me that says, well, maybe that's the idea. Maybe we're all supposed to be so tired by our regular lives that we aren't changing the world. And are we then being turned into an entire society of sheeple who just – so, you know, go like lemmings in shiny metal boxes to our day jobs and do, you know, what we have to do to survive so that we don't have the energy and the ability to get out and change the world. I don't know. I don't want this to be a Debbie Downer kind of conversation, but I think these are I want to hear from other people, men too, not just women, but about how they feel about this. Do they have the energy and the drive to get out there and save the world? Or have we been working on it for so long and are we so frustrated that it's just exhausting?
Well, and I think it's definitely the case that, you know, in the Western world, we are being pushed to an extreme and we are kind of like, you know, tired because we're trying to survive. But I think in the Western world, we also still feel that we still have so much to lose. That if somehow we break outside of the mold, then it's probably going to be worse than the situation we're in right now. And I think that's the difference with a country like Egypt. What happened on January 25th, 2011, was basically that a majority of those people said, it can't be worse. It simply cannot be worse. So, you know, here we are, and we're going to tell this to our government. It cannot be worse. And there is this thing, I think, that, and again, I'm going to go to V for Vendetta. At one point, the revolutionary to be is sort of in, but she isn't. And she goes with V, and basically V tells her, you know, and teaches her through elaborate schemes, which he concocts as a show for her, so that she falls for it and she realizes it, which is that as long as you are afraid of something, you will fail. And that, I think, is what specifically the Western media is so brilliant at, this constant fear-mongering. Here in the UK, the BBC is an expert at it. You know, there will be nothing to fear, yet somehow the BBC will find an angle to a story which says you have to be afraid. And it is, you know, something which really keeps people always on the back seat. Whatever you do, you have to be afraid. In continental Europe, and Belgium is a prime example of this, of the media saying you have it far better than anywhere else in Europe. No, it's not the case. But, you know, if you tell it to the people will eventually believe it. You know, it's a good thing for people to believe that they have it better than somewhere else. You know, it's the classic way of so many governments. And that, I think, is something which is really holding the Western world back, this belief that there is more to fear than there is to be won, that there is more to lose rather than there is to be won, and the fear created around that.
Well, when you put that in the context of being female, sorry, but I have to bring it back to this, you know, it becomes extremely powerful for this reason. You can take the most courageous woman in the world, the most ferocious lioness, the woman who is not afraid to stand in front of an army by herself with a sword in her hand, but if you threaten her children, she will be undone. So what happens with women in this situation is they might want to change the world, but first and foremost, they got to make sure that their family's okay. They got to make sure that their kids are going to eat and that their kids are going to go to school and that things are going to happen that need to happen for their kids. So as long as the family environment in America is threatened, I mean, I think this is true everywhere, but right now I'm really seeing it in the USA. As long as the family environment is threatened at its basic survival level, everyone's powerless. Everyone is powerless, and that is what I'm seeing here. And that is the piece of it that that, you know, challenges me. You know, I mean, what, I don't know what the answer is. We don't have any leaders. You know, 2008, we were all so wrapped up in the flood of hope and change. We were all so excited about what Obama was going to do for us and how he was going to change the world and how he was going to be the voice of the progressives. And that didn't happen. And it's not going to happen if he's reelected. It's not ever going to happen with the current political structure in the United States. There is nobody with the courage to really stand up to the system and make a difference. And that is the piece of it that I can't get around, because I know that in order for me to be an activist and in order for me to change the world, I have to believe that there can be change. So when you're in that place of saying, I don't think that anything I do is going to make a difference, once again, you're disempowered. So, you know, I would love to hear from other people, other activists, and hear them tell us, you know, what keeps you going at this time? What keeps your spirits up? What moves you through this kind of feeling of futility? You know, and again, I don't want to sound apocalyptic or, you know, any of that Cassandra prophetess of doom stuff, because I don't believe that 2012 is about the world ending, as we've talked about many times, but I do believe that there has to be some kind of shift that all of this chaos is leading to. And I don't know what that looks like. But I know that I want to be far more proactive in what's happening than I am now. And this event with this whole vagina event really got to me this week. I mean, it brought up everything I have devoted my life to writing about women and women being, you know, disempowered. And it just hit me in that place. It's absolutely stunning for me. And then I went on, you know, things like the Huffington Post. I can't believe there are not 10 women on the Huffington Post blogging about this, but nobody is. There's one blog by a guy, very good, very articulate, very smart man, good blog. It posted on Facebook yesterday. But why aren't more people screaming about this?
It's a very good question. And yes, write to us. There is a form to write on our website, thespiritrevolution.com. We can listen to your story, and you can be aired here and become a part of this conversation.
Absolutely. I would love to do a show where we interview people who are taking it to the streets, who are activists, who are working to change the world, and I want to hear what it is that they're doing and how they can motivate other people and how we can all be motivated to keep going.
Run to the website, thespiritrevolution.com, and click on the contact button and type in your message. We like to hear from you. We also spent time in the beautiful Rennes-le Château, beautiful as ever, quite often called the secret capital of France. There have been some tremendous interesting events happening there. Over the last few days, we were made aware of something which actually happened a few months ago, but which had not really been reported as such outside of some internet postings. But we were made aware of them. And what is happening is that the world of Rennes-le Château is quite often filled with treasure seekers. That there are people out there who believe that the mysterious priest Berenger Sonnier accumulated a treasure which he somehow found through treasure hunting, and that this is how he accumulated his fortune, and that obviously if somebody were to go to Rennes Chateau and just start digging, he or she too would become the benefactor of the same fortune of Berenger Sonnier, because the assumption always seems to be that you know, somehow there is still something there for anybody who just happens to come across the site where he may or may not have found treasure. But there have been tremendous stories about treasure hunters. One of them is told by our dear friend Toby, as to how in the 1960s somebody, in essence, dynamited his entire garden in search of a secret entrance to something which he believed was secreted away there, as a result of which a gigantic stone was dislodged, actually landing in his own roof, but at the same time also destroying all the windows in the street. There are stories of about 10 years ago about how certain people felt that the water tower in Rennes Chateau was built on top of something secret, and Scandinavians, as a result, decided to once again use explosives so that they could dynamite that water tower. As a result of which, for about 6 months, the locals didn't have any running water whatsoever. And then, more recently, of course, was the story, which also became part of a documentary film called Bloodline, that somehow the tomb of Mary Magdalene was hidden somewhere near Rennes-le-Château, and that a person who went by the name of two men, who went by the name of Ben Hammett, but whose real name is Bill Wilkinson, discovered that. Before we go into that aspect of it, I actually find it amazing, and again, we've kind of, like the first half, we've been talking about how Greece is suffering from a self-created reality. But I find it interesting that, you know, the Da Vinci Code book at the end makes us believe that somehow the body of Mary Magdalene is missing, and that somehow we can find it, that it may be hidden in Rosslyn, it may be hidden in Paris, it may be hidden at one point in Rennes-le-Château. Whereas everybody knows that her body is accounted for, but somehow, you know, we have created the following mystique. We somehow, or, you know, large amounts of people believe that the church is completely unwilling to credit the existence of Mary Magdalene's bones in France, and that somehow they are out there for somebody to be found, which is completely unlike reality.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is completely unlike reality, and it's one of the things that's always made me crazy about people writing about these issues who don't bother to do their homework. And that's 90% of the people who write about these issues. They do just enough work to be able to write whatever agenda or theory they've created that they want to create a book around or a theory around. You know, in Dan Brown's case, I think he read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and Woman with the Alabaster Jar, or his wife did, and then said, hey, this is really cool and interesting. I'm going to write a thriller around it, you know, and God bless him. I mean, he did, and he, you know, opened up the whole world of these mysteries to everybody. But unfortunately, he also, in many ways, did it a tremendous disservice. This, you know, you'd think in this day and age where you can Google Mary Magdalene's bones and at least get some kind of information, you might have taken the time to do something like that. Well, the same thing is with these idiots in the Bloodline movie. And sorry, I'm, you know, hate to be, you know, judgmental, but, you know, these people pulled such a con on the public with this whole Bloodline thing. Oh, we found this tomb, and we watched it happening. You and I both watched it happening, and you and I both knew for different reasons that it was a hoax from the very beginning. But even if I had not had inside information, you know, watching Bruce Burgess on Good Morning America talk about the fact that they had found Mary Magdalene's bones, and then watching him backtrack and backpedal and say, oh, well, we didn't say it was Mary Magdalene's bones. We said it was like the story changed. It was so fluid. The story was changing in the middle of his sentence when they were doing PR here. It was so clear that all of this was invented. But again, all any of these people had to do was some basic research on information around Mary Magdalene's bones. And the Bloodline people, the only research they did was they read the Da Vinci Code. And I have reason to believe that they read the expected one a few times too, based on the story that they concocted. So, you know, this idea that Mary Magdalene's bones are this, you know, enormous thing to be found when they've been accounted for over 1,000 years and very well documented and also analyzed, carbon dated, everything else, is completely ridiculous. But it's also part and parcel to what happens in this world of this mystery, is that people are fascinated by it, but more importantly, people see that it is profitable. They want to make money because Dan Brown showed them that this is a profitable subject. So they want to have a part of that. They want to jump into it, and so they invent without doing any research whatsoever.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things is, to get to the basis of the story, Bill Wilkinson is a guy who we now know in 1999 tried to convince people to do with the Loch Ness research that somehow he had footage which showed the existence of the Loch Ness monster. And when the people of the various Loch Ness societies had it analyzed, they basically fed back to him that the analysis of the footage which he had given to them showed that it was an inanimate object which somehow was moved about, and they concluded and wrote back to him that in their opinion this was a somewhat clever but not convincing hoax. He then changed his name. Publicly, he stopped being Bill Wilkinson and became Ben Hammett.
Let me stop you. Didn't he become Ben Hammett because it's, if you scramble the letters, it's Mr. Tomb Man or something sort of ridiculous like that? Tomb Man. The Tomb Man, I think, is what the anagram is.
Well, originally he made his claim to fame as being the Tomb Man, and then he said that his real name was Ben Hammett, and then people knew that wasn't his real name. Even when people knew his real name to be Bill Wilkinson, people still hadn't figured out what was really going on. But what happened was that even though Bloodline wasn't by any means a success, it did have a somewhat cult following. And what happened was apparently that somebody in the field of alternative research was showing the movie Bloodlines to a friend of him, and that friend of him was actually one of the people who had been working with the Loch Ness organizations, and he recognized Bill from a few years before, and basically said, "That's the guy who has been trying to sell us fake tapes about the Loch Ness Monster." And that really seems to have been the collapse of it all, because for quite a number of years, Bill, a.k.a. Ben, I guess a.k.a. The, was trying to really convince the world that he had stumbled across evidence that nobody else had found. He believed that he had found little files and little bottles with messages which Sonia allegedly had placed in various locations in the area. He claimed to have found certain artifacts in a cave, and when basically he was pushed to say which cave it was, he identified the cave. Now, this was a cave which, since the 1960s, had been dug up and over at least 25 times. Every treasure hunter, it's almost as if, like, if there was such a thing as having a diploma of treasure hunting in Rennes-le-Château, this is the cave which you should have to go into and empty and refill as your kind of, like, graduation test. So it was absolutely known for a fact that there was nothing in this cave, because again it had been dug in and out for about 25 times, and yet he claimed that he had found something in there, to which the obvious conclusion was, well, if that's true, then somebody very recently put that there. It definitely doesn't date back to Sonia's time. So he changed the story. He said that it wasn't in that cave, but in an annex to the cave. Clearly he was kind of like already confabulating there. But the interesting thing was, of course, that he tried to do various things, and he tried to make big claims. And one of the things which I went after with him was the fact that he made certain claims that he was doing certain things with the French archaeological organization called DRAC. Now, I was very familiar, because I was working with them on various other topics at that moment in time. So I was very familiar with procedures, and I also knew the kind of like structural organization of DRAC. And, they are a government organization, which means that they are responsible to feedback to the people. Even though I wasn't a French citizen, they were pretty much not distinguishing between French citizens, and basically I had French citizens lined up who would speak to them on my behalf if they were somehow unwilling to speak to me, which they weren't. And so basically what Bill kept saying was that he wasn't a treasure hunter, that the cave where he had found these bones, which he believed to be of Mary Magdalene, that he was absolutely, you know, in communication with Drac. And I basically said that was absolute BS. And then myself and other people on a number of occasions contacted the Drac organization, and basically what had happened was that there was indeed a very short meeting with Bill, whereby the people of Drac were shown a movie. Afterwards, the Bloodline producer contacted them, asking them for a quote, which somehow then ended up on the sleeve of Bloodline the movie, pretending, making it appear as if it had the full support of Drac officials. But basically the Drac officials said that apart from this one meeting, Bill was never seen again. When they made inquiries, specifically when the producer contacted them, they were confronted with a number of excuses as to why no subsequent follow-up was happening. There were some very interesting, is what I would call it, shouting matches, one-sided between the Bloodline producer and myself, whereas I was not the active person shouting, because I was basically not willing to lay silent about the fact that, you know, this thing was being aired, and was being aired in such a way that it is really, you know, a con. And, well, what has happened is that in the last few months, Bill Wilkinson has come clean. He has said that he is solely to blame, that not even his brother is involved with any of the activities he was doing, even though it is known for a fact that his brother was involved in the Loch Ness scam. He is also, you know, completely saying that none of the people involved with Bloodline are involved. And if that were the case, well, then of course the Bloodline people were not involved. But let me then also say that they are probably amongst the most stupid producers mm-hmm. on planet Earth. So I don't know which has the saving grace there. But also, apparently, you know, apart from the fact that he was identified as a person on the Loch Ness material, he was also trying to create a scam whereby he was pretending that he had found the Ark of the Covenant in the vicinity of Rennes-le-Château, which, you know, I would actually think it would have been good for him that he pulled out at the moment in time when he did, because talking about treasures like the Ark of the Covenant for the last century, he should have known is somewhat going to arouse feelings amongst extremely rich, extremely powerful people who are going to take an interest in what you are doing. Having met and spoken to Bill on a number of occasions, he would not have lasted long if he continued this scam against the interest of those people who were going to try and do everything to get to the Ark of the Covenant before him, and it would have gone to means which would, I think, actually make him cry you know, as a small child when he was going to be on the receiving end of those pressure organizations who were going to get to him to find out whether or not he truly had the Ark of the Covenant location or not. So, you know, I think he pulled out at the right amount of time. But again, he leaves years of destruction. He destroyed several of the monuments in Rennes-le-Château. He clearly has influenced people and once again has, you know, Rennes-le-Château into something which it never was meant to be. Interestingly enough, he still says that despite all of the faking, he is absolutely convinced that there is a treasure to be found. So he is, you know, clearly somebody who feels that even though he's a faker, other treasure hunters should still go out there and search for treasure.
Well, as it turns out, he was in Rennes-le-Château a week or two ago when we were there. I didn't know he was there at the time. That's probably a good thing, because if he ever crosses my path, it might not be a pretty thing. Because You know what? The whole con thing, it's disgusting. It's a criminal act. I don't understand why the man isn't facing charges. But what really upsets me is how much destruction he has wrought on historical monuments in France. And that is the piece of it that is truly criminal. The fact that this man has openly bragged about defacing monuments in Saunier's garden and nobody does anything about it is an outrage. And, you know, the fact that he still has the gall to show up and his confession is very, very weird. You know, the confession goes, it's this kind of strange, rambling, kind of the confession of a crazy man, I felt. You know, I mean, it goes on, and, you know, I didn't do it for the money. I don't know why I did it. Maybe I wanted to see how much I could get away with. And that could also be part of the con, too, because I think, you know, we all know you look, you've encountered him. You have talked to him on a number of occasions. You know him on some level. So you will have more insight into this than I will. Mine are the observations of someone from the outside who has been sort of tormented by what he's done. But I don't know the man personally. But for me, when I read that weird rambling confession that he made, all I hear is someone who doesn't want you to think he did it for the money, even though he did. But it seems to me that everything he did has had financial motivation. He wanted to make money off of this issue. And you know what? He duped some people who are not bad people, but maybe not such smart people. Because when he says these producers of the Bloodline movie are innocent, they didn't know anything, they trusted him and they made the movie based on their trust, I get that. But you know what? There were a lot of people for a lot of years, including us, screaming at them that this was a hoax and giving them all the reasons, pointing out the evidence. It's not like we just stood on the sidelines and said, it's a hoax. We said, look, we know it's a hoax for all of these reasons. Let's be responsible about this. And they all put their hands over theirs and went, la, 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 you're a terrible person and you're jealous because you didn't make this discovery. We don't hear you. So you know what? I am not going to give these people a pass. I am not going to give Renee Barnett a pass and say it's okay for her to have abused you in the garden of Rennes-le-Château and screamed at you and told because you had the guts to stand up and say that Bloodline was a fraud. You know what? Renee Barnett might be a very nice person, but she is responsible for this movie. She is the one who made it happen on lots and lots of levels. And you know what? She had to know at some level that what she was creating was fraudulent. If she didn't know, it's because she didn't want to look. So I'm not giving any of these people a pass. All of these people are responsible for this fraud that they perpetrated on the public. And they are further responsible for the continued destruction of Rennes-le-Château that is happening as a result of it. And it really makes me angry.
Well, and there are various interesting things in Bill's confession. And, you know, again, I was only made aware of it relatively recently, so I haven't gone through to great lengths of it. But, I mean, I actually doubt this claim, which he's making, but he claims that the body involved is actually a real body, which somehow he got his hands on. Which basically means he was handling the remains of a deceased person for faking it, basically, on television. And again, I doubt that this happened. I believe he didn't do any of those things because he is, you know, basically trying to make himself more into what I would call an artistic con man than he is. But, you know, he has said that he has done so. And I would really like it if French authorities were to look into this because he is basically mishandling human remains. And I am extremely upset by the fact that, you know, this is now a very easy case for French authorities to do something about. But clearly they don't want to do so. And it almost comes back to this point of the first half of the discussion, which is that however easy you make it, certain people don't seem to be willing to put a stand and draw a line in the sand and say enough is enough. And so, again, this world seems to be apparently all okay with, you know, letting a man who created a con get away with this. And to a large extent, you know, if he was doing certain things like the Loch Ness Monster, oh yes, that is funny, you know, but he is actually saying that in order to get this scam off, he was handling human remains of a dead person. That is just sick. Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the thing. And you know what? My blood really boils over this. And I think it's very clear because I tend to get a little bit ranty about this. And I know that I have been a little bit ranty today. So my apologies to our listeners. But, you know, sometimes the truth against the world makes your blood boil. Here's the thing. When something like this happens, it makes all of us look bad. It hurts everybody. Everybody who has worked so hard over 20 years to bring these mysteries to light is tarred with this same brush. It's, you know, I get hit with the Bloodline thing all the time. I get emails about that movie every week. And a lot of them are supportive. Have you seen this? Isn't it wonderful? And people get mad at me when I say, I have seen it and it's not wonderful. You know, thankfully, I now have proof. I can now say, look, it's not just my opinion. This guy has confessed. This thing is a hoax. But the problem is that it does create this idea that everyone involved with Rene Chateau is either a nutcase, a con artist, someone who's just trying to make money. And it's, you know, it's, it puts everybody into the same sort of awful pot. We'll call it the crack pot. And I don't want to be in that pot. I have worked too hard, and you have worked too hard on what these mysteries are really about and how important they are to have to deal with this kind of crap. It's not fair, and it's not right. And it's not just us. There are a lot of very legitimate people who are out here working on this stuff, whether they're researchers or authors or people like Toby and Gerda who work every day to make that garden a place where people come from all over the world to celebrate history and culture and love and mystery. The things that happen there are so magical. And you know what? This affects them. This affects everybody who is involved and cares about the mysteries of this place. And so that's why I'm so vocal about it. And that's why I'm so outspoken about it. Because I think after 6 years, almost 6 years of being berated about this movie because I would not support it, you know, I feel a little bit of justification for being able to say, see, we told you so. I'm not usually a we told you so kind of girl, but in this case, I think that we have the right to say it. But most of all, I really want to say that not everyone who works in this field is a crackpot. There are a lot of people who are really doing it for all of the right reasons. And unfortunately, these people are not them.
And, you know, I think what the entire saga is highlighting once again is this notion that it is all about the money and the ego. Because an awful lot of the Bill Wilkinson saga had to do with ego. This idea that somehow he could trick people into believing this ego gratification, and the sense was, I think, even more prominent than his drive for money. Those two things, money and ego, are, you know, again, the core ingredients of the problems which the world is facing in the first half of our discussion. Those two things seem to be going in so hand in hand, and they are so nefarious, and they stand out so much. You know, who is controlling the fate of Greece? The answer is a very few men with gigantic egos who do not want to let go of an idea to do with money. And they are holding people hostage. They are killing people. And the same thing is in Rene Chateau, you know, a guy with ego who basically is going to con the entire world and tries to find how many supporters he has, while the rest either sits back, speaks out, but for some reason, you know, even if you speak out against it, there is this willingness to believe that there is or there might be something to this. And again, I think that's part of the inertia there. You know, like, again, we seem to think that there is something to this world economy, which is based on money. And it's all a joke. Last week, Spain was given 160 billion euros, which almost literally appeared out of nowhere. And guess what? It doesn't exist anyway. It's a number which somebody puts in a computer, which then one computer sends to another, and all of a sudden, you know, the Spanish economy looks better. Problem solved. And that is really something which I find interesting, this notion that we want to be conned, this notion that we cannot accept harsh reality facts, and somehow go into another mode, and then we really kind of seem to get lost in it, and it's very weird. Mankind is in a very strange position at this moment in time, you almost want to say through door one is a very simple world in which life can be good, there are family values, there are spiritual values, and through door B is the world the way it is right now. And people seem to be choosing world B because it's something which they know, and something which they're familiar with. And so this old business model about how change is so hard to push through, whether it's negative or positive, it doesn't matter. It's simply change. Definitely in 2012 seems to be holding an awful lot of sway still. So if you're Renee Barnett, you can go to thespiritrevolution.com and you can send your apologies there. But also, if you.
Don't hold your breath, honey.
Okay. If you want to con me into believing that Renee Barnett is sending apologies to me, you can also use that same contact form. However, if you have opinions about the state of the world where we are in, we are actually days away from June 21st, 2012, which means we are roughly within 6 months of December 21st, 2012. That day where really, I think, it really is a mirror. It really is a mirror as to, what do you believe? And the person who believes the world is going to end, fine. The world who the person who believes that there is absolutely nothing to it, fine. But all of those people, those kind of belief structures, really say more about those individuals involved, I think, than really the answer they are giving. So if you have thoughts about all of these subjects, but specifically, this show is called The Spirit Revolution. There are spirit revolutionaries out there. The world has been changed on numerous occasions, but I think the one difference between the old world and the new world was that a Martin Luther King or a Mahatma Gandhi, a Joan of Arc, they had a few millions of people to contend with, a country, however many million there were in. But now it is global. And so how do you go about bringing about change on a global level? Is it possible that one person does it, or does it actually require the work of billions? And how do we learn from the revolutionaries of the past and the people who are revolutionaries on a small scale right now to bring about real change? Because it always happens to be, I think, that if somebody doesn't direct change, change is going to happen anyway. But that change is not going to be as nice or as controlled as when actually change is strived for and worked at.
I want to jump in
So.
real quick because I just got I got a post while we're on the air here from one of my Facebook friends, Joanne Springsteen, who is currently on the steps of the Capitol building waiting for the start of the show. Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues is happening. Eve Ensler herself flying in to do the Vagina Monologues in response to the censorship of Lisa Brown and Barb Byram for saying vagina. So the fact is that there are people who are taking action. There are things being done to draw some attention to it, and I just wanted to support those people who are out there today on the steps of the Capitol building and participating in this demonstration about what's happening, because that's what we need to be doing. And so I am inspired by people who are taking some action, and I want to acknowledge it when it is happening.
Absolutely. And what has happened is that we have reached the end of our show today. We will be back next week, as usual. If you want to listen to this show again, you can do so through a number of means. You can go to our Facebook page, where you can click on the show and listen to it from within Facebook. You can go to iTunes and download it. You can go to thespiritrevolution.com and listen to it there. So, several means of listening to today's show, and both the Spirit Revolution and iTunes also gives you access to our archives. And if you want to hear every show we have ever done, you can go to bbsradio.com and click on the archives there. You will be charged a small fee. However, you will not be listening just to us, but to all other shows which are being aired on BBS Radio. So, until the next time, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.